Session number 17629, David Ridley, Reel 11.
How did you move around the mountains and the ridges that you had to climb and descend?
Well, once you were discovered, as I said before, that an infantryman who was a jack of all trades, we either had to clear a way through the minefields, or if we had time, used to send for the pioneers who used to come up with mine detectors. But anyway, there was pathways made through the minefields. And they were all marked. Even the Germans used to mark the minefields, I think for protection for their own selves. But anyway, once these tracks was made, that you had to stick strictly to them, otherwise you became a casualty.
How did you clear the minefields if you didn't have the pioneers to help you?
Well, years ago I was on a mines course, down in Buckinghamshire, I think it was. And mines are laid in a set pattern, or should be, because if you lay mines and you're the victor, you've got to take them up. And if you haven't laid them correctly, you're liable to have lots of trouble. I don't think this happens in places like Africa, and where I think they just lay mines willy-nilly. So a mine, German mines were laid in a set pattern. And all you had to do was find the key mine, and then you could near enough spot exactly where each mine was. But most of the time they use mine detectors. For us, the unfortunate infantry, we had to use our bayonets, we used probable bayonets, and when you felt something. Then again, the German was very clever. He came to the point where he used to put booby traps on his mines, so if you tried to lift them, they used to go off. He had mines whereby, especially for, he used to put on roads, where a truck would go over, but wouldn't explode, the first truck wouldn't explode it, because inside you had a metal bar of copper and a guillotine, and the first truck used to cut the metal bar a little, a few fractions of a centimetre. Then the next truck would cut it a little bit more, and when it actually went up, it was probably the tenth of, a truck's long way behind that you used to explode. He used to do all these sort of things. One of the main mines that we encountered was the shoe mine. It was always nicknamed that it could take your shoe off without undoing your laces, and actually, in fact, it blew your foot off. It was made out of a wood box with explosives inside, and you used to lift the lid up when it was set. And if you stood on that, it exploded, and you used to take your foot off. Now, I've always said this, but it never did happen. I had a friend, a Sergeant Pluck in the battalion. He belonged to Brinton. And this fella had a premonition. He used to say, "Dave, I don't want to go into action. I know I'm going to get it, I'm going to get me lot." And we used to say, "Oh, you'll be all right, And anyway, this happened once or twice, but the time that he did get killed, he was talking to, not just me, to the rest of the sergeant, and he just didn't want to go into action, but he went. There was no fear of him not going. And this was in the area where we were breaking through into the Po Valley. And something else I learned in the Po Valley, rivers are not as we know them down in a valley. They're built up. The fact that most of the Po Valley below sea level, the river's banks is built up. And this particular place there where we had to cross, the German had mined all the embankments. And unfortunately, Sandplux was one of the leading platoons. And another strange thing that happens about minefields, it's not the first man that walks in the minefield that stands in it. You find that in this particular case, the whole platoon was on this embankment when the first man stood on it. And then they were standing on them right, left, and center. And unfortunately, this Sandplux, he lost one leg, and as he turned around, you know, to fall, he lost the other one, both his legs were off. And I was in a reserve platoon. When I went forward, they had him on a stretcher, and I was talking to him, you know, oh, you'll be all right and all this, sort of keeping his spirits up. Then the doctor came, and I just left, and I never saw him anymore. Oh, later on, he was checking back, I think it was in Fawley or Fianza, one of those towns, there was a hospital. And my friend, who was the colour sergeant of our company, that Tudor Davis, as I've mentioned him, this Welshman, one time when he went back for rations, he went down to the hospital. And unfortunately, they told him that he died. So the blast had gone up his back body and destroyed his tummy. Now. Very unfortunate. He always used to carry this on, a photograph of him and his missus when he was married, and he was in uniform. But he belonged brilliantly, actually. And I always said that if I ever caught anybody laying mines, I would have no mercy whatsoever. Fortunately, I never did, you know, catch any enemy troops laying mines.
It must have been a very frightening situation to find yourself, in effect, in a minefield. Was there any pattern as to what you should do if that happened?
Yeah. Well, most of the times, I think what you should do, actually, is stand still and then stand and think. Well, I'm in a minefield, and which way did it come in? And you just sort of turn around slowly and walk on the path that you came in. But that never does happen, that. And as I say, the German had all sorts of mines. I mean, that shoe mine was a deadly one. But he had one, and I've just forgotten the name of it now. It used to have three prongs, used to stick out the ground. And he could fix trip wires and all sorts of this thing. But if you stood on this, it allowed you to, I think it was 3 seconds, it allowed you to step off it, and then it had an explosive in the bottom of the mine. You used to blow the piece out, and you used to come up about 3 foot off the ground. Then it exploded, and it was filled with ball bearings and all sorts. And it used to catch a terrible lot of people then. The time that I was awarded the DCM. I was in a reserve platoon, and we'd done part of an attack, and the forward two platoons were attacking a farmhouse. And then, while we were waiting, either to get called forward or to do something that Major Gray would want to do, I heard lots of cries for help. And I went forward and I saw these two fellas lying with one, you know, one in particular had he lost his leg and he tied a handkerchief or something and he put a tourniquet on with his bayonet. And I said to him, I says, well, I'm sorry, kid, I can't carry you. I'm too loaded up with equipment. I couldn't have carried him, it was too heavy. And what I I got a hold of this fella and I dragged him back to where my platoon was and handed him over to the lads. I went forward and I got another one out. There's no time that I realised I was in a minefield. I didn't even think of it. But in the heat of battle, you don't, you know. Anyway,
so how many men did you bring out of the minefield?
I brought two out, and I sent one of me men back to, there was a farmhouse a bit farther back, about 150 yards back, where I knew the medical were there, and I sent them back for the stretcher bearers, and finally got them out of there. From there, we diverted the attack onto a hill that was called a Sugarloaf Hill. And I've never known anything so blooming scary in all my life. Anyway, we got onto the top of this hill and we dug our trenches. And during the night, German patrols just keep coming up, popping up all over the place. And that's the nearest I've ever been to a German, you know, apart from, you know, capture. They were popping out of the ground about 5 yards away from me. You know, they were crawling forward and then couldn't find anybody, and they stood up, and then that's where we spotted them. And this is the time where I was on about these automatic weapons, the immediate action that you normally carry out when a weapon stops is not in the training manual. And this is if you cut a weapon for a long period of time, when you press the trigger, the return spring will not drive the working parts forward fast enough to fire the weapon. And that happens with a Bren gun and a Tommy gun. And in this particular time, there was, I must have been about six Germans about 10 yards away from me, stood up. I had two Tommy guns because one of me caught, the only corporal that I, you know, I told you before, I had one corporal, two corporals in my service, but only one at one time. And this one was a chap called Trophy, and he got wounded. So I had to send him back. Well, he left his weapon, so I had two Tommy guns. I was in a trench with Joe Buick, at my number one on the Bren gun. The Bren gun wouldn't fire. The Tommy guns wouldn't fire. All your brains fly out of your blooming ears. But fortunately, one of my men threw a 36 grenade among this crowd. I suppose some of them would get wounded, but they're all running away. We saw quite a lot of Germans off in that particular time.
This was all in the same action when you got your award?
Yes, uh-huh. Now, when daylight come, I knew for a fact there was a big dugout on this hill, because when we did a recce before the attack, you could see this dugout dug into the hillside. What we were told then again, not to worry about that. The tanks are ranged on that. When your tank starts, they'll start pumping rounds into this dugout, which they never did, you know. In fact, it was a massive one. There's quite a lot of Germans in there. Anyway, during the day, we were sort of dozing, and I heard this, you know, Tommy gun fire. And the next thing I know, he's Major Gray with two Germans. Took them down the hill. And later on, I don't think I should tell you exactly what happened there. But he was under orders, Major Gray. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He was under orders to do this. And then he went forward again. And it was only about 20 yards away. These Germans were taking such as he was taking them out, you know, and getting rid of them. Hair-raising it was. After that, while we're on there, the German had we had the 36 grenade, which we were able to fire out of a cup on a rifle. The German had more or less the same thing, but his looked like a candle, a long candle. And used to fire this, and it used to explode on impact, not like ours with a fuse. This used to, if it hit anything, it exploded. And this German fired this at me, and I ducked into the trench. Well, the trench was so narrow that I could only get my head in. I couldn't get my arms in. I had my arms out on the top of the parapet, holding my Tommy gun. And this thing hit a grapevine, exploded, And the shrapnel hit my Tommy gun and splashed into the back of my arm. Give me a slight wound. But if I had not had my head dug down in that trench, I would have probably got it in the head. But the trenches saved, the slit trenches anyway, saved a terrible lot of lives.
Where was this action that you got your award?
The farmhouse that we were attacking at the time was called the Casa Bianca, the White House. And I always remember, years after the war, I bought from one of our agents, actually, Major McBain, who used to breed West Highland Terriers, and I bought one of them, and I named it Casa Bianca, because it was so beautifully white.
Your citation mentions the fact, of course, you were in the minefield bringing out the two wounded, but it also mentioned your leadership during that action. Were you in command of your platoon then?
Oh, yes. As I say,
do you recall any other events of that action that...
When I was just saying there something about Major Gray, well, I think I better put it on, it'll be on record in any case. He shot these fellows. But we were ordered, before we went into action, you had to take no prisoners. Now, we were sitting on a hill, on this Sugarloaf Hill, looking down into the valley where we first did the attack, and not just Ranger Grail, we all could see all our friends lying dead in this minefield. And I think Major Gray, I remember one of his marshals, that's for Corporal so-and-so, but one of his corporals had been killed. And I think himself that he just made his chap up to Lance Corporal, and he was so annoyed that he'd been killed that I think about, remember, so about six people off. But
is why you got the order to take no prisoners.
We had
because of
the orders not to take any prisoners. That's correct, Dad. And a little thing that bears on my memory there. It's not so much shooting somebody. When you sit and watch somebody die, it's a curious feeling on you. Not long after that, I would say in less than a week, pamphlets was coming flying over. We know you've been shooting prisoners, and you know what's going to happen if you get caught. So we were being observed. Now beyond this farmhouse, this White House, there was another big ridge with a lot of farm houses on the top. That was our main objective. We finally got up there, and the Germans retreated, like. And by then, my arm was right up, swollen. I couldn't do nothing with it. And Major Gay says, "Well, you better go back now." He says, "Everything's all right now. I'll get someone else to take your platoon over." So I went back. I went back with a colour sergeant when he came up, actually, my friend. But I didn't go to hospital. I went to the local medical place, and they checked me out, and they said, "Well, there's nothing broken, and it's just a matter of time and allowing the swan to go down." So I actually stopped with Tudor Davis in this big farmhouse where they had the headquarters. And... See, the colour sergeant used to come up at night with the rations and meal and whatever, ammunition or whatever he wanted. And I used to relieve Tudor. I'd say, "Well, you can have a night off, I'll go." And that's when I got to know, on this particular ridge where the company was stationed, I went up this particular night, and Major Gray says, "You've been awarded the DCM. But he didn't say what for, nothing like.
So that was your first intimation, the first that
That's
you knew
first,
that was happening?
Yeah, verbal information from him.
What were your feelings? What were your feelings at the announcement?
Well, I'm very proud. I thought it was just commanding a platoon and, doing an officer's job, really. It wasn't until I read the citation what it actually was for. And I still can't comprehend yet that I went strumming around a blooming minefield in the middle of the night.
What date was it when this action took place?
Date? Oh, I can't remember, I don't think. Look, my card.
When you're awarded a medal, congratulations all around, do people...
Oh, yes. There was somebody, I think it was 45 or 44, this happened. So when I went up, all the platoon was highly delighted that I'd been awarded, because I think I was about the first one that was awarded anything in the company. And everybody was congratulating me, like.
At what point did you get your ribbon? We'll deal with the medal now. What point did you get your ribbon? Did that come early?
Yes, it came reasonably early, but I couldn't tell you the time after the action. We were still in action, actually, when I got a card from the Army commander with the DCM ribbon pinned on the card, saying that I'd been awarded. I think I've showed you it there before.
And you have to wear your ribbon after
part of
your dress.
Yes, sir. Well, you're in properly dressed if you didn't
Who
know.
Who actually gave you the medal?
King George VI, actually.
That was when you came home, was it?
When I came home, you had to apply to go and get your medal. I was given a rail fare, the passage, and passes to go into the palace. And there was another great honour for me. We all had to line up in single file and go, and we were told exactly what we were. We had to halt, turn to our left, don't stamp your feet because you're on a wood, a wood partition and you might go through. Don't stamp your feet and bow. And you all had a big ring, or a hook actually, clipped onto your uniform. And the king just picked up the medal and had a big ring on it, and he just plunked it onto there. Now, every so often, he stopped to speak to someone. Because, I mean, there was, you know, hundreds there. And I mean, he was knighting people and doing all sorts. But anyway, he did, when I took the pace forward and he put the medal on my chest, he says to me, "Where did you get this from?" Which took the wind out of his sails, because I didn't expect the king to speak to me. And I said, "I got it in Italy, in Fienza, Your Majesty." And he said, "Oh, yes." And that was it. I've passed on.
What were your impressions of him?
Well, I thought he looked very ill, to tell you the truth. I think he seemed to have a terrible lot of makeup. Of course, he's doing a duty to his country, like, and everything was laid on. I mean, he didn't even have to turn or do anything. He just dropped his arm, and there was a cushion with a medal on or whatever. He was going to push it into his hand, and he just grasped it, put it on, you know, presented it to you, shook your hand, and that was it.
So coming back to the mountain that you were fighting on...
Uh-huh.
What are your memories of what happened next?
Well, from there, we were withdrawn out of the... See, we were in foothills at the time. We were drawn out of there. And then we were doing, more or less, for a long, long time, advance of contact. That was just, and as I say, the main German army had pulled out. But he used to leave companies and snipers and machine gun nests and all that. And when we got into onto the flat ground in the Port Valley, I mean, normally we were used to being in a line in set trenches, and then there was either a valley and another hill, and that's where the Germans were. And they were about, I would say, maybe 100, 200 yards away. But when you got into the Port Valley, you're fighting from house to house. And I mean, 20, 30 yards, you'll be in one house and the Germans will be in another one, as near as that.
What is the skill of fighting in houses, of street fighting? How do you do it?
Well,
because you would be in the attacking situation, they'd be merely the defending one.
That's right. Well, the best time, in my opinion, to do any attack is at night. Do your reconnaissance during the day. Either do get compass bearings, prominent buildings, prominent trees, mark them in your memory, and then attack at night. And the best time to attack is when they're asleep. Now, in the Great War and all that, they used to attack at dawn and attack in the evening, and they would just be sitting waiting for them. In fact, there's a standard drill. Stand two in the morning, stand two at night, because this is the time when you're going to get attacked. But not in the last war. The best time to attack is 2 o'clock in the morning, when they were asleep. Very difficult attack on houses. You put most of your machine guns, your brain guns, covering your troops going in. And the things that they covered was the doors and windows of the building. You probably have to have give them a secondary order, because all German troops didn't fight in a house. They fought round the house. So their trenches were around the house, but they more or less lived in the house. So you had to have weapons trained on round the perimeter of the house. When you got near, 9 times, when you got anywhere near, the up sticks and off, because as we say, we're fighting to, you know, the contact. Sometimes they were very angry, like, they used to attack you, which happened a few times. And I remember I was telling you about this sergeant plug. We were crossing this river when we stood on a load of mines. Well, we still had to go over that river. Those mines had to be cleared. There had to be a track cleared over there. And it's the first time I ever did a river crossing. I got a boat. Most river crossings that I ever did, I waded through. You know, up the hill and water. They say, well, how do you get dry? You say, you just walk till you got dry. Your body heat used to dry your clothes. Now, I think I mentioned this before, when we were being reinforced by anti-tank personnel. And I also remembered saying that if you're going to get killed, you're going to get killed in the first 3 weeks. After that, you learn to go back to nature. Well, this particular chap, he was out of the archery. He was a corporal, actually. And when we got over the river, I had to consolidate in this particular farmhouse. And I said to this young lad, you're lying behind a bunch of twigs. I says, it won't even stop the wind, Dad. Now, we went about 200 yards forward, and there were some houses on a road. And I was in one, and we got attacked by a German platoon. Well, while we were beating them off, the mortar just, and one of the mortars stopped on the roof of this house, so about where the spout line was. And the next time I got myself sorted out and looked around, here's this Robertson line with a great big hole in it. He'd been hit in the head, killed him.
The crossing that you're talking about by boat, was that the River Montoni, which is described in the records?
It probably was. I can't remember the name of it, but
that was December 1944.
One of the rivers that they embanked, the sort of lift the water above the level of the ground.
Were you coming across a lot of booby traps?
Not a great lot. No, not a great lot. But they were there, and you had to be cautious with them, especially when they're cleaning houses. Houses that weren't occupied. I have gone into a house and found loads of mines later on, but whether they were hooked up in a booby trap, I don't know, and I never went any further. Another interesting thing, what we were talking about just now, one of my platoons, or one of the platoons of the company, who had a chap called Sean McGarry. He belonged to Houston.